Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, a podcast between four friends, all theologians from four countries across three continents. My name is James Eglinton. I teach Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm here today with my friends Corey Brock, the pastor of St. Columba's Free Church in Edinburgh, Marina Steyong, pastor of the Oosterpark Kerk in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and Grace Utanto, who teaches at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. So this is the final episode of season one of Grace in Common. We've got to this stage already, and we thought that today, to round off season one, we would finally get around to answering some of the questions that people have emailed. So we're always really grateful to listeners for getting in touch anyway, just so that we know you're out there, but also to engage with some of the ideas that we've been discussing and trying to develop. So we have a selection of those today, and we're going to do our best to try and get through as many of them as we can. And at the very end, we'll also end the season with an exciting book giveaway for a couple of books on Neo-Calvinism produced by members of the podcast team. So first question, which has been sent in by a listener, is the question of what is the distinction between Neo-Calvinism and Neo-Kyperianism? Or a Neo-Calvinist and a Neo-Kyperian. A couple of episodes ago, we had Vince Bacot from Wheaton who joined us talking about his work on Kuiper and race. And I think this is what this question refers to. He identified himself as a Neo-Kyperian. So this listener is asking us to clarify, what is the distinction between a Neo-Calvinist and a Neo-Kyperian?
It's maybe also interesting to bring into memory one of our first guests, who was first George Haring, who said he did not want to be called a Neo-Kyperian, but did want to be called a Neo-Calvinist. So there apparently is something in this difference, although I would say it's hard to like pin down exactly what the difference is. But I guess we could say that being a Neo-Kyperian is part of being a Neo-Calvinist.
I think it's really important to clarify that the Neo-Kyperian term was first coined by Vince Bacot and then later Richard Mao in the context of the discussions on race, right? So when we're talking about Neo-Kyperianism, it's that posture of wanting to retrieve the best of Kuiper against himself. So Kuiper had all these racist statements, but Kuiper at the same time had a lot of liberative and very universal corporate accounts of humanity in his corpus. So how do we use those corporate accounts of humanity in Kuiper himself to get beyond the racist statements that Kuiper himself made? So Vince Bacot talked about a need for a Neo-Kyperianism, not just repristinating all of Kuiper, but actually using the best of Kuiper against himself. And Rich Mao, in his 2011 Little Introduction to Kuiper, echoed Bacot's approach there. So I think that's the term Neo-Kyperianism. It's in that context, very specific context of the race discussions in Kuiper. And I think if you relate it back to George Haring's comments about why we want to be Neo-Calvinists instead of Neo-Kyperianism, he's actually, I think, trying to say that also in the context of the racist claims, but instead of framing it in terms of getting, you know, the best of Kuiper beyond himself, we want to make sure that Kuiper is just one voice among the broader Neo-Calvinist trajectory, and not all figures in the Neo-Calvinist trajectory made racist claims the way Kuiper did. So we don't really need to just hinge all of our foundations on Kuiper himself, because other figures are better on this topic than Kuiper, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's helpful, Gray. I think the origins of the term Neo-Kyperian in this discussion with Vince and others, that's very helpful to know. I think that might push against what I instinctively think of when I think of Neo-Kyperian instead of Neo-Calvinist. It's more helpful and more nuanced, but the term Neo-Kyperian to me has always meant more, and this may be because of my background, more of an American movement that has gone in 1,000 different directions that tries to just use Kuiper as a background in theological construction, period. And so I think of Neo-Kyperian theologies that have gone in totally opposite directions in the US, but still find their principal figure as Kuiper. And, you know, we could name those, and maybe we should, I don't know, but and the difference, as Gray just put it, in my mind at least, is that Neo-Calvinism, it uses Kuiper to be sure, but is drawn a theology and a instinct that's drawn more from the Dutch tradition, the modern Dutch tradition period. And a lot of that is because the Neo-Kuiperian world of thought in the US especially is developed in the 20th century when Bavinck's not translated. And so you just don't have the ability in those years to draw from Bavinck like Kuiper. And so, so Neo-Kuiperianism to me is where Kuiper is the principal figure of origin that then is used to develop all sorts of streams of theological subtraditions that are based on the instincts of Kuiper or some of the meta doctrines that Kuiper really pushed. But Gray, your distinction of how it particularly pertains to race, that's very helpful.
And I think this takes us back to our very first episode. I think it was the first or the second episode when we were trying to define what Neo-Calvinism is. And something we raised there is that the term is used with a lot of precision by some people, but it's also a bit of a catch-all term for things that other people don't like, and it gets used with a lot of imprecision as well. So if you do a Twitter search for Neo-Kuiperian, you'll find some people, like I did this, it's a bit of prep for this, and you'll find someone like Matthew Kamink, who is a Reformed theologian who self-identifies as a Neo-Kuiperian, and that's done with a lot of intentionality. But then you'll find others who use the term with a lot less precision, and it's a kind of boogeyman term. And the same as with Neo-Calvinism itself. And for a lot of people out there using it in a very clumsy, popular way, Neo-Calvinist and Neo-Kuiperian are actually interchangeable and equally kind of meaningless as well. They're not searches for the truth about how people who use those labels intentionally use them and the meanings that they fill them with.
Yeah, so to go back to the last episode, Mike Allen pointed this out in the last episode that, for instance, the eschatology that he mentioned in Richard Middleton's work that overemphasizes continuity between the now and not yet to the point that de-emphasizes the center of eschatological hope in the beatific vision, that I think carefully defined is a product of a Neo-Kuiperian theological movement. And we would say that that needs to be strongly distinguished from Neo-Calvinism, from Neo-Calvinist theology, that those wouldn't be the same thing. And part of that includes that Neo-Calvinism, which goes back to the sources on Kuiper, understands that there's a big difference between Kuiper's own eschatological theology and what is being argued for there that Mike was trying to treat. So that would be a prime example. Another example in my mind that James just pointed to would be, for instance, quite often in books, especially books surrounding political theology, books about the two kingdoms, et cetera, you're going to see Neo-Calvinism used as a boogeyman, as a transformationalist movement. And if you look at Bavinck and Kuiper, you can't actually find anything that's resembles what's being critiqued, but you can find it in later iterations of what might be called Neo-Kuiperianism, right? So that would be, I think, just one example of how this plays out and how we need to capture the distinction between the two for the first time, really.
Yeah, maybe also something to add from my Dutch context is that the Neo-Kuiperian word is really something strange to the Dutch language and to my context. It just doesn't exist here. While Neo-Calvinism is something that does resonate here and is a term that has been around for a long time. Well, we talked about that before. It was already around in the time of Bavinck and Kuiper himself. So I guess that also gives it somewhat of a more broader and more international meaning, while Neo-Kuiperian has, I think, in terms of its context, at least, a more narrow meaning.
I think we could contribute to muddying the waters even more if someone would dare to introduce new Kuiperian as well, just to balance out the whole neo-new Calvinism confusion and debacle. Shall we move on to question two? Getting through our list. So the next question that someone sent in was about the term grace restores nature. this is really axiomatic within Neo-Calvinism. It's really closely linked to Herman Bavinck. What is meant by this term?
I guess I can take a stab at it first. I think one way to helpfully understand this term is by by contrasting it and comparing it with other adjacent terms like grace above nature and grace alongside nature, right? So the idea of grace restoring nature is that grace and nature are both not only complementary, but grace actually helps us see nature anew. Grace helps us understand nature in light of the work of Jesus Christ, and that Christ's work is precisely to make us more human, more naturally human. So if you contrast that to the idea of grace alongside nature, it's when one is converted into Christianity, one is regenerated by God, that Christian life is just adjacent to or put alongside natural life. So Christianity doesn't have an impact on the family, let's say, or Christianity doesn't have an impact on your secular vocation. And Christianity just puts you into a new sphere of existence, namely the sphere of the institutional church. But once you are out of the sphere of the institutional church, that is the sphere of the natural and the purely natural at that, right? So in the idea of Christianity and nature side by side, there's these two adjacent tracks that really don't commingle with one another. They don't interact with one another. And to say that Christianity transforms or redeems or refashions your understanding of some natural sphere X is really a crossing of a boundary that you shouldn't cross. And then there's the idea of grace above nature. This idea that when you are transformed by the Christian faith, it doesn't change anything in the natural world either, but it does allow you entrance into a supernatural sphere of existence. So this may be a rough sort of analogy, but one way I try to think about it is, you know, if you have a view of Christianity as above nature or grace above nature, it's like, you know, you're flying to a certain location and you're getting to the flight and you get upgraded into first class. That's Christianity above nature or grace above nature. But in the grace restoring nature paradigm, it's not that you get upgraded into first class, but rather the whole plane was broken and destroyed, and Christianity comes and refashions the whole plane, if that makes sense. So that Christianity doesn't just get you to a higher order of existence, but it actually causes you to rethink the ways in which you think about your job, the ways in which you think about parenting and family and dress and art and science and culture. All of these areas of life are not things that are separate from Christianity or things that are irrelevant to Christianity, but it's precisely what Christianity wants to restore. It wants you to take a look at science in a way that now you could use science to glorify God, or art and science and culture, or whatever else.
Yeah, thanks, Gray. I mean, the simple biblical background to this is just to say that grace, of course, is a term that refers to God's covenant of grace expressed in redemptive history, climaxing in the cross of Christ. And nature really just means creation. So another way to say it is just that the grace of God in Jesus restores creation. So, I mean, the biblical background is simply this, that the goal of creation expressed in the Edenic temple in Genesis 1 and 2, and its ultimate consummative hope in God condescending to be with humanity forever, that is the exact same goal that Christ is achieving in his cross and resurrection unto new creation. So that when the covenant of works is ultimately fulfilled by Jesus Christ, grace restores creation, grace restores nature. Of course, this is now and not yet until new creation. But, you know, this is just, grace restores nature is really like classic understanding, reformed understanding of the covenants and the basics of biblical theology. And, you know, any reformed biblical theological text like a Voss, like a G.K. Beale, etc. So grace restores nature. That's the biblical background of it. That then gives way to what Gray was saying. It also manifests in an ethic. So if God is renewing all things in Christ, making all things new, making all sad things come untrue, if he is achieving the goal of creation through Christ, then what does that mean for the time in the now and not yet? What does that mean for us in the church as we try to witness to that reality that grace restores nature in the present day? And as Gray put it well, you know, it doesn't mean that we, it has to mean then that we can't separate ourselves from what God has given us in creation, which includes the cultural mandate, Genesis 1, 26, 28, right? It means that we have to witness to new creation in the now, in showing that grace does indeed restore nature. So grace can restore the family to what it was always intended to be, not ultimately until Christ returns, but it can certainly witness unto that end in deep change in the now. Grace can restore a workplace, not meaning that that workplace is going to carry into the new heavens and the new earth. It doesn't mean that some particular business is going to last into eternity, but it does mean that that business can show forth an aspect of new creation, witness to new creation in the work of the gospel and the movement of the Spirit across a business, across the way it interacts with its customers, with its employees, et cetera. So
Chick-fil-A shout out here, right?
Yeah, Chick-fil-A shout out. There you go. Perfect example. So yeah. So much more to say. It's grace restores nature is the relationship between creation and recreation. It's precisely why we call recreation recreation.
Yeah. So let me.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. So let me. So you now framed it as like this is like general reformed emphasis, right? Mostly over against maybe Lutheranism or Roman Catholicism. That's at least how Bobbing and Kuiper often frame it.
Right.
But so do you guys think that, so how is this particular neo-Calvinist, because I think the person who asked this question has heard us say it a lot, and we do say it a lot. And so, yeah, how do you guys think this is particularly new? This is something they, is it just something they lifted out of the Reformed tradition and emphasized? That's kind of, I think it is, but maybe, or maybe they also added or changed something to it.
Yeah, so I think that it is something that, like, the roots of it massively predate Neo-Calvinism. Yeah. I think that it's just a deeply Augustinian insight about sin and the world. So for Augustine, sin isn't something that exists in and of itself. Rather, sin is a lack of the good. It's a disorder of what is made as good and to be good in the world. So it's a good creation cast into chaos and allowed to fall into disorder. And that's just an insight that runs, you know, there's a vein of that through the Western Christian tradition before Neo-Calvinism. But Neo-Calvinism, and I think particularly Hermann Bavinck, this is such a repeated emphasis in his thought throughout his dogmatics. It takes that Augustinian insight and really presents it with a lot of acuity in a late modern context, with fleshing out what does it mean to approach sin and the creation, the world in which we live, with that kind of Augustinian view of sin as disorder. And what does that mean for how you live in a secularizing world? So there's a line in Bavinck's Dogmatics where he writes, "Grace serves not to take up humans into a supernatural order, but to free them from sin. Grace is opposed not to nature, only to sin. Grace restores nature and takes it to its highest pinnacle." I think that insight for me when I first read it, that the only thing in this world that grace opposes is sin itself, I found that a really transformative thing to be reminded of and to learn in a much sharper sense through Hermann Bavinck, particularly if you live in an urban context where you're jostling with all kinds of different cultural diversity all the time. You live in the modern age where things are changing constantly and you're always trying to find your feet and work out which things are good and which things are bad. And that kind of insight for me anyway, I find really personally transformative in learning that not all that's different is bad and should therefore be rejected, but instead you have to have a much deeper process of learning to love wisdom in order to see what is the disorder and what is the sin, because that's the only thing that you truly have a ground to oppose and that you have to actually, because it is sin. So for me, I find grace restores nature kind of life-changing, and especially that idea that the thing in this world that Gray supposes is sin, and that's the only thing.
And just to try to anticipate a potential objection here, grace restores nature is not, in our minds, emphasizing the continuity of this age and the next age to an extent where we de-emphasize the beatific vision at all, because the fact that grace has come to restore the original goal of creation includes the fact that the beatific vision was the original goal of creation, that the whole point of the Edenic temple and the covenant of works was ultimately to consummate in the condescension of God, Emmanuel, in some sense, with his people. And we see that already present in God's manifestation of himself in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. And so we recognize fully that when grace restores nature, that means the condescension of God to humanity, the union of heaven and earth, with its center and most important aspect being the beatific vision, right? So I think this is where, you know, even back to last week's episode, some of the debates have happened in the past. We're thinking grace restores nature means utter continuity between this life and the next, to the point where we expect all the artifacts of creation to just carry over in exactly the same way, except without sin. And we want to say, no, grace restores nature means that the theology of Eden and its hope of consummation in Christ becomes even greater. And the beatific vision is at the very center of that.
Yeah, but still, I think it's, I totally agree with you that this is not what it means. But I do think it's good to say, and maybe you disagree, but you can tell me, is that the Roman Catholic tradition, with its like grace, like comes above nature, is more inclined to have a stronger ecclesiology and a stronger notion of the beatific vision and of the like the emphasizing the difference of the hereafter compared to now. While I think Neo-Calvinism and Reformed tradition has a tendency of like making the church less important, because it focuses so much like on that grace restores nature, namely all of life, that plays out coram Deo before the face of God. And because it emphasizes continuity, it may give the impression at least that like the beatific vision is something that is less important and there's going to be a lot of continuity between this life and the next life. So I think it's good to say that. And I mean, I often have that when I use, like, for example, liturgical tools from the Roman Catholic tradition, I find that they offer more words and have a stronger tradition in like speaking about heaven, about angels, and also have a really strong strong ecclesiology. So yeah, I think it's not something that New Calvinism wants to do, but it is at least a tendency it may have, or something where it may lead to, and also has led to, I think, in history.
I think a way to summarize this is to say that the grace restores nature emphasis as a Reformed emphasis sees a lot more emphasis, to use that word again, on in the Bible, on the concept of divine condescension rather than human ascension. And so I think in the Roman Catholic tradition, the emphasis is more on ascension and on humanity moving upwards, whereas in the Reformed view, the grace restores nature view, we see the emphasis more of God coming down, and that ultimate hope is always condescension, not ascension. And I think that's where the foundational difference lies.
And I wanted to just maybe close this part of the conversation on grace restores nature by adding one thing that is related to what you were saying there, Corey. I think it's great that a listener has asked us to clarify what does grace restores nature mean, because I think that it's a very misunderstood aspect of Neo-Calvinism, particularly in critiques of Neo-Calvinism from people who are more two kingdoms inclined. So a common critique that you will hear there is that Neo-Calvinists approach cultural transformation by applying soteriological ways of thinking, you know, gospel, redemption, future transformation, to cultural things that we encounter in the here and now, as though you transform something by pointing it, you know, forward to the eschaton. Actually, in Neo-Calvinism proper, you point them back towards creation, right? So grace is restoring what's there in nature.
Yeah, and so, and if you want to read more about this, there's a book by Gray and Corey coming out soon, Introduction to Neo-Calvinism. And in chapter five, it's entitled Grace, Resource, Nature, right? It's about that, isn't it?
No, it's creation and recreation, but that's exactly what it deals with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So buy the book. Next question. Someone has emailed asking us if we can discuss the relationship between believing and belonging as understood in the Neo-Calvinist tradition. And so I think this probably ties into an earlier discussion that we had. I think when we were talking about the psychological insights of the Neo-Calvinist tradition, and I think when we were talking about preaching, Corey, you raised this in talking about the community of hearers who listen to preaching as there's a community that you can belong to in some sense by joining as a listener, and that's the community where, you know, faith comes by hearing. But what does it mean when you're there and you're hearing, for example, before you believe? So how does Neo-Calvinism equip us to think about the believing belonging question?
Yeah, I'll be interested to hear what others say about this. I guess one way that just immediately jumps to my mind is that Neo-Calvinism helps us to understand that theology exists to address people in the age that they live in every single age, and that preaching has to adapt and contextualize to the place, the city, the rural context, the village, and also it has to address the issues that are very prominent in its contemporary cultural context, right? Whatever ideologies that might be. And so the belonging in order to believe phrase, as I understand it, as it gets used about, batted about all the time now, is a phrase that specifically addresses how to do ministry in secular humanist post-Christian context. And that is to have a church that doesn't talk about people who don't believe in Christ, but talks to them very regularly, that anticipates and expects and hopes that the community of faith as it gathers will include people that aren't yet persuaded by Jesus Christ and the claims of Christ. And so the church needs to, because of the context it may be in, understand that ministry has to contextualize in that way and allow people of all belief systems to belong before they might believe, to belong in a space that they don't agree with, and that the church needs to accommodate that and needs to make sure that that audience is spoken to and loved on in very particular ways. And so our church, we have a lot of examples of that right now where I am. And we try to practice this in our church context weekly and think about every week and preaching and all sorts of ways are we speaking to the audience that doesn't yet believe the claims of the gospel. So that's the way I understand the term. And I think Neo-Calvinism offers just a big call to understand the importance of contextualization.
Yeah, I think I do recognize that from the context I work in here in Amsterdam, is that we also found that we also have like visitors always in the service. So we also try to adapt our language and our sermon to make sure we also show that we realize they are also there and make it understandable for them. And the other thing is that we've had for the past years, just people who come visit the church and come very often and then ask, can I be a member of this church? And then I ask, well, are you a believer? And they say, no, I'm not a believer. I'm very interested in it. I really love this, but I really want to be connected. I want to receive the newsletter. I want to pay money to keep the church afloat and stuff like that. So, and now we have created, and many other churches in the city do it as well, created a kind of membership, which is not really like we have Baptist members and we have like confessing members. And this is like a third, we call it a guest membership, which has a limited time. So we say we're going to do it 1 or 2 years and then evaluate it, but they become part of the community in some ways. And we find that this is very helpful because people long for this community, apparently. They really want to be part of it. And I think it's also a great way for people to like get to know the faith just by doing the practice in some ways, just by, so like they are a part of it and then are given the opportunity, I think, to be shaped by what they see and what they do, and also be shaped by the community. and then at some point may even come to believe, or not, of course. We do not know that. So yeah, I recognize what you say, and we have had this practice. I also have to think about something Schilder does. So I've said before in this podcast that Klaus Schilder was worried about that the church was something that was neglected in Neo-Calvinist thought. And I think he was right to see that some ideas from the Neo-Calvinist tradition were used in a certain way that downplayed the importance of the church. And he said, well, in my culture, so in the first half of the 20th century, I see a lot of people talk about community. Community, Gemeenschap, was a buzzword in literary circles, philosophical circles in the Netherlands. There were journals who were founded who were called Gemeenschap, community. So he saw that, and he then sensed that the church had something to offer and to connect to that longing in society. And so that was, I think, for him, part of the reason why he emphasized the church not only as institution, but also as community, as something really important, as kind of an asset of Christianity that should not be downplayed in his time, but should get a more important place. And I think the times are in that way very similar. I still have the idea that, at least in the Netherlands, for example, loneliness is considered one of the most profound problems that disrupts our society. And we also see that the secular authorities just do not have the tools to change that. They want it. I see this on a local level in the neighborhood where I work in Amsterdam, that I see the organization struggle. How should we deal with this? And I think here as well, the church has many tools potentially to offer, where it can, well, it offers community, very deep community, and which does offer a remedy potentially against loneliness. So these are just a few things I have to think of. There's a lot more to say, but
the loneliness epidemic is a big problem in the UK as well. We now have a government minister whose portfolio is loneliness, which is a really sad thing, that's a task that's handed to the government, and secular authorities really struggle to respond to it. But in my church in Edinburgh, we talk a lot from the front about regulars as a way of thinking through this believing and or belonging issue, because there are people there every week who are exploring Christianity, who are trying to work out what they think about it. And so we find just addressing the regulars in the congregation is inclusive in that regard. It also applies to the people who are there regularly because they do believe and they profess that explicitly. But then there's the difference between those two groups becomes apparent when we have the Lord's Supper, for example, because there we do make it clear that there are things that are for people who do believe, and that there's a distinct place where you belong there, the Lord's table, for example. But we find the language of addressing regulars really helpful. But something that's really worthwhile in the Neo-Calvinist tradition on this specific point is having some tools of cultural and historical analysis to help us understand why, particularly in secular Western cultures, the question in the first place of why you might need to belong for a while on the path to believing is so significant. At the moment, I'm reading through Kuiper's Pro Reggae. Wrote it in 1907 or so, originally as newspaper articles. It's now out with Lexham Press. And this is, it's really interesting. It's Kuiper's most significant work on Christ as King over the whole world, also over secular spaces, that Christ's kingship extends to everything. And Kuiper writes this after his time as prime minister is over, at his least culturally triumphant. That's when he produces, I think, his most profound work is on Christ as King over all things. And that work is a really fascinating analysis of secular Western culture as having moved from a history where you have a core of people who are professing active Christians with a really vital faith, but also you've always had, like, there was always a large nominal Christian population as well, sustained in how it lived and orchestrated its life together through having Christ as King. But now that's gone, and instead you have this rapid shift that Kuiper recognizes, where most people are functionally totally illiterate about Christianity, and but you still have this a much smaller core who for whom Christianity is a, you know, a high cost buy-in in a culture that no longer esteems it. So how do you help these people whose grandparents knew more about Christianity, but they are now two generations separated from that? How do you help them understand, or how do you help them find something to belong to in order to believe? Because the belonging issue for him is one of the big struggles that Kuiper identifies in secularizing Western culture. The family is being reimagined. Everything is rapidly individualizing, and the narrative of society is so thin that people need to belong to something, but they also don't know what the church believes. So there's I think Neo-Calvinism also has some really worthwhile resources there, and how we approach the issue of belonging on the road to believing.
Yeah, I think one last comment on this is the idea of the covenant again, right? That Neo-Calvinism builds on the Reformed idea of covenant theology, that ultimately we have a corporate understanding of membership rather than a individualistic understanding or Baptistic understanding of membership, where believing becomes the absolute precondition for membership into a covenant community. So I think framing it in that way, and also understanding that Neo-Calvinism builds on that with this very emphatic corporate understanding of humanity as well. So I have a hard time of envisioning a neo-Calvinistic Baptistic theology because of these reasons. And I wonder if we can reflect on that in a future episode, because I think neo-Calvinism has such a healthy view of corporate solidarity, corporate responsibility, corporate membership, and corporate humanity.
So I just want to continue a little bit in this and push you also a bit and see what you see. This is something that may not work, but just going to try it live here. So the idea of the covenant, I was thinking about that too, what you brought up, Gray. And so do you think that, so there is this, in Reformed thought, there is, we baptize children, right? So there are those who do not have yet have faith, and there's this long time when they are not yet a believer, but they are part of the community, and they're part of the covenants too as well. They've received the promises of the covenant, and I've always seen that as like what it means that they're in a covenant is because they move in a certain sphere, right? They are in the sphere of faith and of the church. It's their parents, it's their family, it's the church. It's the fact that they go to church. It's the fact they read the Bible, that they learn to pray. And I think that is what it means that they are in the covenant, right? So they are kind of in the sphere of, they're in the sphere of the church, in the sphere of Christ also in some ways. And so I wonder, could it be that like our guest members and those people Corey mentioned who just visited church, are they in some ways also part of the covenant, or is it in other ways problematic? I think in some ways they are part of the covenant just because they take part in the community even though they're not baptized, and they cannot be baptized unless they profess faith.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's probably something we need to all think about to provide a clear and definitive answer on these issues. Mm-hmm. I do think that exposure to the covenant gives them more responsibility. So I'm not sure I could immediately say that they're automatically covenant members in the same way that children of the covenant are. But there's definitely a sense in which they are more responsible for what they know because they're exposed to it. So I think of, you know, the warnings of Hebrews 6. I think of sort of the category of the God-fearer, you know, the of the Gentiles in the Old Covenant, things like that. Because of their exposure, they do have greater responsibility.
Yeah, but also enjoy benefits of the covenant, of course.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
All right.
So conceptually, like in Kuiper's way of analyzing this, it's almost like the image of concentric circles, where the center circle is the circle of people who are baptized, professing, believing Christians. And then in his way of thinking, in the past in Western culture, the rest of society was the next ring of the next concentric circle around it. And that was people who I think he describes them as, they went along with Christianity without living along with it, or something like that. It's maybe a slightly clumsy translation of the Dutch, but so they were kind of carried along by Christianity rather than very actively swimming along with it. So there's this current anyway that will carry them. And now that has been lost entirely. So there is only the center circle now of people for whom being Christians means that they're actually actively swimming against another current. And without any of the other concentric circles around it. So for I think what Kuiper is trying to think about how to recreate is how do we incorporate the people around the only circle that's left, the center circle, into something like a next ring where they can be carried along by the current of Christianity in order to enter the center circle of people who truly believe it. So for Kuiper, that was just the whole of like almost the entirety of the space that is Western culture until very recently, and then all of a sudden there is only this hardcore group of Christians in the middle. So I think that the whole conversation is just about thinking with the resources of the tradition about how we add another concentric circle, which it looks like is now needs to be done inside the life of the church, the visible church anyway, to create that as some kind of a place where people can allow themselves to be carried along by the rhythms and the norms and the intuitions of the gospel and of a life-oriented Coram Deo, and give them that as a space simply because wider Western culture will not provide that anymore in any sense. It doesn't provide any Christianizing norms to reset people's intuitions. So the church has to become a place that is patient enough and accommodating enough as a community to allow people to be carried along by Christianity for long enough to work out whether they want to swim along actively.
Yeah, that's a helpful way to think about it, James. And one of the ways in which I ask this question in class is, why is the non-Christian of the Western world so different than the non-Christian of the non-Western world? Very different intuition. So the non-Christian in the non-Western world is incredibly hierarchical normally in their thinking. So I'm thinking about my own, background in Indonesia and then my own exposure to folks in China and Hong Kong and Singapore and the Philippines, things like that. So the non-Christian in those sort of contexts is very hierarchical in their thinking. Usually they have a very inflexible understanding of male and female, that these two genders are not at all, constructed by a social sort of linguistic context. They normally have a high view of the authority of the family. They normally have a high view of spirituality, of dare I say, even superstition, the tethering of physical objects to spiritual entities. So why are the non-Christians in the non-Western world incredibly religious and familial and patriarchal even sometimes, whereas the non-Christian in the Western world is remarkably egalitarian, forgiving, tolerant, not exclusivistic, and so on? And I would have to say that it's because of the influence of Christianity by Providence, right? So Peter Leithart talked about this new category, not just of common and special grace, but of middle grace. This idea of a people that is not just influenced by the general revelation of God or common grace of God, but rather of also the influence of special revelation that has become a part of the overall broader cultural milieu in which they lived. So they might not know that it's a Christian influence, but there's an inheritance of Christian influence there. And I think that's a helpful way to think about those concentric circles that you talked about. The people in the outer sphere may still be impacted by Christianity, even if they're not going to the church, if that cultural milieu historically has been impacted by Christianity.
Yeah, indeed. And again, the Neo-Calvinist tradition does have some terrific resources in thinking that through. Like the last chapter of J.H. Bavinck's book, Personality and Worldview, is a really helpful, masterful, concise account of actually, even within Western culture. It's interesting, it's a slight pushback against Kuiper a couple of decades on. There's J.H. Bavinck thinks that society is still Christianizing people to a degree. But the people have absolutely no idea that that's where these norms and values come from. So within the tradition, even, if you read through Neo-Calvinist authors over the decades, it's still an extended conversation as well.
Right.
Let's tackle, I think, the last question that we can try and get through today, and we'll need to be a little bit brief about it. But a listener has asked, I'm about two-thirds of the way through The Wonderful Works of God, and it's been tremendously encouraging. Is anyone writing like this for today? Who is the Herman Bavinck of 2022? I got the year right by the end of season one. It's not 2021.
I think one Herman Bavinck in the 19th to 20th century requires at least like five people working in tandem. It's a hard question to answer, isn't it? I do think that while we may not immediately, I don't know what you all think about this, but while we may not immediately identify a particular person, we do identify some intuitions and some inclinations that are exemplified in Bavinck that maybe we'd want to emulate in our own day. So, you know, a deep reading of our own Reformed tradition, the broader Catholic tradition, standing on those sources, while at the same time, a broad engagement with contemporary discussions. So if in Bavinck's day, he was, you know, relating the Reformed ideas to the newer ideas of freedom, of plurality, of authenticity, of feeling and things like that, maybe today it's the issues of linguistics, the issues of cultural diversity more so, and the issues of whether or not there's you know, systemic racism, whether or not there's ideas of gender that has really been socially constructed. You know, how should the Christian tradition think about these newer issues? So it's not just parroting what Bavinck said, but it's that kind of model, this Catholic yet modern inclination of writing theology to see the newer ideas, even if they're, you know, at first glance, really antithetical to Christianity. And in many ways they are, there's a sanguine openness to using those ideas and showing that the, you know, even though they might be articulating in ways that are antithetical to Christianity, they're still grasping for something that is good because they're made in the image of God, right? So how do we show that Christianity makes for a better home for these newer philosophical concepts that are around today?
Yeah, that's a really wise and helpful answer, Gray. I wonder if, maybe reading this into the question, but if part of the question about reading wonderful works of God and wondering, is anyone writing like this today? One way that you could read the question is the same Bavinck who wrote the Reformed Dogmatics as this scientific textbook at the very highest level also is the same figure who writes a wonderfully accessible, intellectually rigorous, doxological, readable single volume work of Christian theology that's been wildly popular because it's pitched at the level of people who like to read books but who aren't theologians. Are there theologians who write like that today, or is that just a challenge for theologians 100 years on, that the cultural conditions that the academy forms us in haven't been helpful in producing, you know, like one individual who wants to write at both of those levels? I think that that's something that's changing a bit in the UK academic culture for the better. I think if you were to go back 10 or 20 years in UK academic culture, also for academic theologians, you know, who'd aim to write at the kind of level that Reformed Dogmatics was written at, it was really looked down on to engage too much with ordinary people. Academics did academic work and that was it. And that's something that's changing a lot now. So it's much more valued in the UK academic culture that you can communicate your research to non-specialists, to general public audience. But that kind of cultural change takes a long time to normalize and to give academics more practice and confidence in how to communicate in the way that Bavinck could, you know, translate Reformed Dogmatics into the wonderful works of God. So maybe it's just a cultural issue, and maybe that's why Bavinck is compelling and attractive to people 100 years on. I mean, he's doing very well what academics now are encouraged to think about.
I was going to say Christopher Watkin at Monash is pretty exemplary because he has a lot of academic texts related to French philosophy in general or atheism in general. Yet at the same time, he's got a lot of lay-level material. So I'm thinking about his Thinking Through Creation for PNR. But now he's coming out with this tome of biblical critical theory where he's trying to engage Reformed biblical theology on the one hand with all of the newer modern and classical ideas. So he's got chapters on, you know, creation and cultural diversity. He's got chapters on corporate responsibility, chapters on time and imagination and eternity, things like that, while looking at all of that through the lens of Reformed covenant theology. And I think it's really, really a fruitful work. And that's coming out with Zondervan at November this year.
Yeah, I do agree with you, Gray, that it's real difficult to think of people who can do like everything Herman Bavinck did now at the same time. But someone that comes to my mind is also, he's from the Netherlands, but I think his books have also been translated. This Gijsbert van de Brink. he does it on certain fields, but his book, for example, on creation and evolution is really an example of engaging a pressing question from our time and also taking on developments in science, taking it very seriously, talking grace to source nature. And then confronting it with theology, looking from it from the viewpoint of from theology and asking just, well, what do these findings of science mean for Reformed theology? Are they compatible or are they deeply, or are they not compatible? Are they just something that conflict with each other? And how can we, or are there ways and maybe we can change things in our tradition if that's needed? So I think that's a very, I mean, we can discuss about what we think about the outcomes of it, but I think he really does a great job in really taking seriously these scientific engagements, this the scientific findings and well, going all the way that, and then connecting it profoundly to theology. So, and I think he's right now, he's working on a similar project, but not about evolution, but then about the notion of climate change and of the way we deal with the environment. That's not such an issue, which is hotly contested, of course, but also very important contemporary issue. And then asking, and important to ask the question, what does it mean for theology? And what does it mean to look at it from a theological perspective? And does it have consequences for our theology? So yeah, I guess he's also an example.
I think another Dutch example might be someone like Stefan Pass. So he's someone who has really polymathic interests, originally an Old Testament scholar, writes a lot about politics, church planting. He is the J.H. Bavinck Professor of Church Planting, I think, at the Free University of Amsterdam, but also someone who is just a great public communicator. I listened to his the Ongelofelijke podcast by Radio NBO1. So I am their only non-Dutch listener, probably, but it has a really big audience in the Netherlands, and it's so engaging across a variety of topics. So someone there who is a proper bona fide academic and a public intellectual at the same time. Yeah. And I think that that's something that the Dutch tradition has preserved in a way that I think is much weaker in the English speaking world, where the public intellectual is also the university intellectual, and where those are two like hats worn by the same person. I think in the English speaking world, the public intellectual is very often a separate class of person who writes popular books on intellectual topics, but that person usually doesn't have a PhD, isn't accountable to the academy or anything like that. So you know, they're the kind of people whose books you would see for sale at an airport that people who like intellectual things would read. But those are very rarely, I mean, sometimes they do exist. I mean, in the UK, someone like Mary Beard, classics professor in Cambridge, who also writes and does incredible stuff for the public, she's a rare example. But I think in the English-speaking world, we separate the two a lot. And that's also just the kind of cultural water that theologians swim in as they're trained as well. So Bavinck is someone who is a striking example because he's so different. But I think it's really encouraging to look at younger Bavinck scholars who are emerging, who are learning those instincts from Bavinck in the English-speaking world. So, I mean, someone like Jess Joustra, who has a PhD on Bavinck, doing academic work on him, but also who writes really great stuff for the public audience. If you read her stuff in Comment magazine, for example. So, but that's something that's encouraging to see as a development, but it's kind of countercultural. So I wonder if a lot of that is in the background to the question too.
Yeah. So maybe we can round this off by just quickly going to the final question we have. And that's a question about Herman Dooyeweerd. The question is, what is the place, importance of our view of Dooyeweerd in the New Calvin tradition? And I think we've mentioned him a couple of times, and I think it's also good to add some other feedback we got on this podcast, is that we've presented New Calvinism very much as a theological tradition. We are four theologians, and we discuss in a theological way. And it's good to use this question also to say that, yeah, well, the New Calvinism is broader than just theology. There's also a philosophical tradition that's very much alive even till today. And Dooyeweerd is obviously one of the fathers of that philosophical tradition, but also like thought on politics, on law, and economics is also part of this, of the education. but part of the Neo-Calvinist tradition, something we have covered less, and we may do so more in the next season, but we'll have to go a little bit beyond our own field of expertise. And just a brief note on Doyle Weir, when we just I think 2 questions ago we had this discussion about, like, what I think James was saying, that about how important it is to have like an account of our Western culture, and how much that is the Christianity is intertwined with it. It's someone else we've mentioned often is Tom Holland and his book Dominion, where he has said it. But the first time I was encountered with that way of looking at history and the history of the West was through a book by Doyle Weir. So his book Roots of Western Culture, that's the English title. It's really a book that for me was the first time I learned about worldview and about how like different motives have played a role in the history of the West, and it was really helpful for me at that time to understand that. So there's a lot more to say about Doyle Weir, and we are not most qualified to do that, but that's just a little bit of an answer to that the question that was asked.
I think in season 2 we will definitely record some material on Neo-Calvinism and philosophy. I'd be well up for that. I'm sure David too.
Yeah, that'll be fantastic. Comment on Doyle Weir. I do think that, you know, here's how I think about Doyle Weir, and I know Doyle Weir and listeners are going to email us or message us on social media when we comment on Doyle Weir, so I'm going to have to be ready for it. But you know, when I think about Doyle Weir, I think about him as trying to smoothen out the tensions that are there in first generation Neo-Calvinism. So I think, you know, it is admittedly very true that when you read Kuyper and Bovink, there are some strands of reasonings that seem to sit uncomfortably with one another, right? And Corey had mentioned some of that. You know, a lot of folks think that Bovink's grace restoring nature motif eclipses his beatific vision motif. Then we've got his, you know, romantic motif that seems to not mesh with his some more Aristotelian motifs. And I think when you read Doyle Weir, there's a sense in which he's kind of frustrated at seeing some of those potential tensions. I don't think there are tensions in the original material, but I think Doyle Weir thinks there are real tensions there. And so he wants to smoothen it out and say, hey, what's the more purely biblical material in contrast to the less biblical material that's there in Kuyper and Bovink? And I think in his desire to smoothen things out, we may lose some of the Catholic depth and richness of a Kuyper and a Bovink. But at the same time, I do think that Doyle Weir is quite a genius in his own right. I think the ways in which he tried to smoothen things out, he really did create a sort of master paradigm to understand all of the different fields of life, all the different motifs of life, the different modal aspects of life from a reformational viewpoint. And it is worth considering. And I also say, therefore, that he's an important second generation Neo-Calvinist or third generation Neo-Calvinist, trying to apply Neo-Calvinistic insights to law and philosophy. And he is definitely worth reading if you haven't read him, because I have found that every time I go to read Doyle Weir, he's way more impressive than later Doyle Weirdians, if I could put it that way. He's really quite a challenging figure and often misunderstood, I would also say.
Great. I think we are at time and should round off season 1 of Grace in Common at this point. But we're rounding it off with something a bit special and unusual, which is a book giveaway. So we have 2 books to give away to a listener who will be chosen at random. The 2 books are The Klaus Hilder Reader, produced by Marinus together with George Herrink and Rich Mao, published by Lexham Press, and Herman Bavinck's Christian Worldview, which Corey Gray and I translated, which came out with Crossway. So if you would like to win those books, we ask you to share this episode on social media. So those of us who are on Twitter, which is Marinus, Corey, and myself, we will all share this episode on Twitter. So if you retweet one of us with a suggestion for something you would like us to discuss in season 2, then you will be entered into this competition to win these 2 books. And you have to do this by the end of the month.
July.
Thank you, Gray, for keeping me right on dates as well as years over season 1. So enter online via social media on Twitter, But for now, thank you to the listeners for joining us for season one of Grace and Common. It's been great fun for the four of us. We've all thoroughly enjoyed these conversations, and it's been really heartening to know that lots of people are listening in, and we thank you to everyone who submitted questions as well. So we'll be taking a break from the podcast for the next couple of months over the summer, but if you like and rate and subscribe to Grace and Common on whichever podcast app you use, then you will automatically find out when season two reappears. But we plan to start recording again in August, so keep an eye out for that. But for now, thank you again for joining us. This is Grace in Common.